Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com.
A production of Serotech Corporation, creators of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft.
Welcome to Serotalk. Podcast number 22. This is Michael Loft.
And I'm Richard Wells.
Oh, he said it like a true broadcaster.
I hope so.
Thanks for joining me today, Richard.
Well, it's good to be here.
Yes. We're trying to bring in some different voices in the Serotech crew. You, like myself and Buddy and many others around the world, installed the new Snow Leopard for the Macintosh probably this past Friday.
Yes, I did.
And a very interesting operating system. A lot of nice fixes. Someone said that Microsoft made a statement, we don't charge for service packs. Well, I'm sorry, this Snow Leopard is much more than a service pack, especially from an accessibility standpoint.
It's a completely different thing. They've definitely fixed a lot of features in the Snow Leopard. A lot of enhancements, automatic reading of web pages.
We're going to do a 30-minute segment coming up later in this podcast. We'll be speaking with Scott Rakowski and Jesse Hernandez, who had installed it before I did, and we talked about it as I was installing it, and I did the default upgrade path to it. Some people are doing a clean install, and there are certainly benefits to both, the pros and cons. But also coming up later in this podcast, we're going to be speaking with Jerry Wheatley. He lives in Louisville, Kentucky, and actually builds homes from scratch. He's totally blind. Of course, he started out sighted with it, and he has a little help from his family, but does the majority of the work, and he'll talk about that, not only the construction side, but the business side as well. And also, because System Access right now is the only screen reader working with the NFL Field Pass, we're going to show you how you can not only listen to the live games, but we're really going to focus on the archived games because none of the other screen readers afford that technology right now. NFL has sent some instructions to people showing them how they can at least listen to games real time as they're happening, but no one has the archives unless you're using System Access, and we'll show you how to do that. Richard, you are also doing quite a bit with Windows 7, and this Thursday night in the upcoming Tech Chat number 31, we're going to be talking about Windows 7, the pros and the cons of it, the real deal, shoot from the hip. So I know you have an opinion or two about that.
Yeah, I have several, and so I hope that folks will drop by and ask questions about that. We're going to have a good time with it.
Come by, ask any questions you have, or if you've been using it yourself, one of the betas, not too many people have their hands on the real deal unless you work in the software industry or actually build hardware boxes. You probably don't have the official release that was put out on August 6th and will be made available to the masses on October 22nd. You can also put Windows 7 on your Macintosh, just as you can any Windows version if you're using the VMware Fusion. Which is interesting because, Richard, there's two camps. I mean, there's some people, I don't want to tarnish or stain my Mac with Windows, and others who've specifically bought Macs because they can have Mac and Windows running side by side. So if they need to run an application that they haven't found software for on the Mac, they can do it in Windows as well.
Especially when Macintosh decided to go to the Intel platform away from the PowerPC, which I strongly resisted at first, but now it makes a lot of business sense and a lot of sense because it does make it cross-platform compatible both for running Windows on a Mac in Fusion and also in Bootcamp.
Before the Mac fans get too diehard, there have actually been quite a few improvements in the 3.0 for Bootcamp so that it works better in using Windows.
A lot of hardware detection tools have been added to make it more compatible with the Windows 7 environment.
So whatever you're into, Windows or Mac, it's all good. It's all evolving. That's really what we want. Although I have to say the accessibility of Windows 7 is not quite advancing in the way that I'd hoped. I guess there is some improvement for partials, right, as far as screen enlargement.
If you use the search feature in Windows, as a matter of fact, I think a lot of people who haven't used search feature before are going to be using it in Windows 7 because it is a lot better than it ever has been. In a lot of ways, Windows 7 is more like Vista Service Pack 3 than a new operating system.
I couldn't have said it better. I must be honest. I mean, I have a real love-hate relationship with Microsoft. Obviously, it helps me do my job and keeps me employed, but I really wish at some point they would become socially responsible and really enhance the native screen reading technology.
I would love to see that. I hope that Microsoft does come through with some things. And I know there are a lot of screen access vendors in the industry on the Windows side who have a lot to lose if Microsoft actually does that. So it will be a bittersweet thing if Microsoft does that. Accessibility is a right, as we like to say.
Yes, it is. Join Richard. He'll be joining me and all of us Thursday evening in the Tech Chat. That's 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, 6 p.m. Pacific, or 1 a.m. actually in the UK if you want to get up and join us for that. We'll be talking about Windows 7, the good and the bad and the...
Indifferent.
Definitely. This is Michael Loft, and I wanted to do a segment on how to use the NFL Field Pass because I understand most screen readers really are not working with this site. The NFL has sent an email to persons asking, telling them that they are working on some revisions and have sent a workaround. But, from what I'm told, no other screen reader other than System Access currently allows people to listen to the archives of the games, that being a replay of the game after it has taken place. This does work with System Access, and I want to briefly show you how to do that and give you a couple tips that may help you regardless of which access technology you're using. First, you sign up, obviously, for your NFL Field Pass, and the price, I believe, is about $29 a year. And that is just for audio. You can have video, if you like, as well. That gets kind of expensive, and I don't know the exact price for that, because obviously that uses a lot more bandwidth to show you the video for the game as well. But once you've set up your Field Pass, what you want to bookmark and where you want to go to is https://fieldpass.nfl.com. There you enter your username and then your password. And here's one tip I think that may help a lot of people. Go past the button that says Launch Field Pass. It is actually a button. And tab a couple times past that to click here for Low Bandwidth Version. And we'll do that now. You'll notice when I click on the link that says
click here for low bandwidth version link,
System Access will, as it does on most websites, begin reading the page for you, including audible tones that let you know which items are links.
Connecting. Windows Internet Explorer. Connecting. Week. Game date. Time. Away team. Home team. Please. 3. 2. August 27. 7:00 p.m. Jacksonville Jaguars. At. Philadelphia Eagles. Home. Away. 3. 2. August 27. 7:30 p.m. St. Louis Rams. At. Cincinnati Bengals. Home. Away.
The three you keep hearing means this is the third week of the preseason. St. Louis at Cincinnati. The first city you hear is actually the away team, so we'll click on the away button to listen to this St. Louis announcer.
Connecting. Windows Internet Explorer. Welcome. Button. My account. Button. Start of Flash Player.
So we're at the start at the top of the Flash Player.
Welcome.
And then it says welcome, and then your login.
Button. My account.
The first button is labeled, says my account.
Button.
The next button is mute. So the audio is continuing to play as we look down.
Button 000018. Button, button.
And again, we can press the space bar on the mute to unmute. And there's our classical music that they, or instrumental music that they play for the commercial breaks.
Button.
The third button is the halftime button. So once I press this, it will jump to the second half of the game.
0158.59.
As you hear, 1:58:59, 1 hour, 58 minutes, and 59 seconds. We're now into the game. Which sounds like a lot for 30 minutes of play,
forward,
but keep in mind that this is the radio
is
broadcast.
This is the Rams Halftime Show with your host, Tom Casey, on the Rams
0, 1, 59, 18.
So right below the time elapsed,
game number three, number
there's another mute button.
0, 1, 59, 25. Button.
And we'll press it again to unmute.
Our score halfway through.
Button. The next button is unknown. I really don't know what function it performs. Perhaps it's something visual. Below that, you heard it say mini mode is a toggle. And it toggles between standard and the mini mode view. Then we have the word audio, and below it, the team whose audio we're currently listening to.
St. Louis Rams.
In this case, the St. Louis Rams. Then we have four volume buttons. The first one sets it to the lowest possible volume. And then each one subsequently turns it up a little bit. Here's number two.
Quad Crosby, a rookie from Texas with the 49-yard return on the Donnie Jones punt. And so Cincinnati goes up 7-9.
So there you hear all four buttons. You do have to watch. I'm going to turn it to the lowest again.
With a catch for a first down.
So you can hear. But you do have to watch because sometimes the screen refreshes and it moves on you. So you do have to pay attention to that. And keep in mind these points of reference
2009 button. Refresh.
Then below 2009, we have a button that says refresh.
Preseason three.
And right there, it tells us which week we are in. In this case, preseason week number three.
All teams.
And then we have all teams, and these are archives of the games. We now have 16 buttons. First one, we can go back up the screen or search for the audio and look at the team below it.
Button audio, Denver Broncos.
Eight teams, the direct link to listen to eight different teams, and then there were eight different links to Game Center, which took you to different places, I assume for the different divisions and so forth. But what's easier to do at this point, rather than interacting with the 16 buttons, is to simply close the window. We are using Internet Explorer, so simply press Control-W, and then you're back on the page with each game and a link to the home team radio feed or the away team radio feed, so you can listen to the announcers from the cities that you enjoy most. It is certainly possible to listen to these games on demand and the live games. You can listen to it, and I truly believe they will do as the MLB, Major League Baseball, has done when first going to Flash, and made some adjustments to correct the issue, and hopefully other screen reading technologies will be able to work with it at some point soon. But for now, why not? If you haven't done so, get a copy of System Access, www.sa2go.com. Try it out for 30 days. Better yet, buy a copy for yourself and enjoy all the great fun and excitement of football for 2009. Whether you're visually impaired and are a mechanic or work in radio, we take what we do for granted. But looking at someone else, I think for many of us, is amazing. So today I wanted to speak with someone who I'm kind of fascinated with the work that he does because it's so foreign to me and I haven't a clue. But today we're speaking with Jerry Wheatley in Louisville, Kentucky, who not only builds homes, literally from the ground up, then sells them, or sells some, rents some of them, and basically has made a pretty good business for himself. I want to thank you, Jerry, for joining us today.
Hi, Michael. No problem.
I'm sure some people right away are blown away, just like, wow, this guy builds homes?
I grew up on a farm, and I had RP. As a kid, I was a high par, so I saw pretty good. But on a farm, you know, if you need a barn, you know, you build it. If you need anything done, you do it. So I kind of grew up with tools of one kind or another in my hand. So as I started losing my vision, and I'd lost most of it by the time I was 30, I went back to college, finished my degree, and got me a fine little desk job in the big city. I was working behind the desk, getting a little fatter, a little sorrier every day. And I really was looking for something physical to do. And I had an uncle that lived in Louisville in the same area that I did. And he was constantly telling me, hey, you need to buy your house, fix it up, live in it, and then rent it and buy another one. So I did that. And that's the first house that I rehabbed, let's say. It was a little three-room shotgun. I bought it, moved in, fixed it up while I lived there. Then a couple of months later, a house down the street went up for sale. I bought that. Moved in it, rented the first one, fixed it up, and, you know, lived in it. And that's the last time I lived in one I fixed up. I'm telling you, that was a mess. I wasn't allowed to do that again. It's been something that I've enjoyed. It gradually went from, you know, fooling with the rentals to building a few houses.
So where did you get these skills? I mean, did some of it come from family members? Did you just kind of play around and volunteer? Or
like I said, I grew up with tools. After I lost my sight, or most of it, you know, using a hammer, driving nails, it didn't seem to make a difference. I really believe that there's a lot of skills that people have who are sighted. They think you couldn't do them without your eyes, and I really think that your eyes are more verification that you're doing it. There's so many things you can do without your eyes that you wouldn't think you could do.
So when did you build your first home from scratch, from the ground up?
I actually farmed till I was about 30, late 20s anyway. And so I was in my early 20s, and I needed a house. So I built a little two-bedroom house, did just about all of it except for the brick, pouring the foundation. I'm not saying it was perfect, but the house is still there and still has tenants in it.
You actually started by fixing up homes and then at some point just decided to build them from the ground up. Explain that process.
I've been in it a little over 20 years. I went in with my uncle and a cousin, and I have a cousin who is a real builder. He's really good at it, done it all his life. And then my brother, who was in the construction business as far as backhoes, digging footers, and that kind of thing. And we kind of would partner up. We'd buy foreclosures. We would fix them up, flip a house or sell it, or we would fix it up and keep it and rent it. And we've been doing that for 4 or 5 years between the three or four of us. You know, we had 40 or 50 houses, rental houses, most of them in Louisville, some of them out in the area I'm from, which is Lebanon, Kentucky, out in that area. I noticed something starting in the, say, 96 or 97. A lot of the older houses, the utility bills started getting so high. It's when natural gas started really going up. And I started having a little bit of trouble out of tenants being able to pay their rent in the wintertime. And I thought, man, this is only going to get worse. And so I got interested in building energy-efficient homes. We sold most of a lot of the older houses we had, and we started building a few. And we would build some, sell them, and then I would build a few and keep them. That's really what got me into building, is natural gas going up. I mean, I built a few before that, but I'd never really, you know, took a real strong interest in it until the gas prices started really going up. The electric and utility bills were getting just extremely high in some of these older shotgun houses. It's really hard to make those houses efficient.
Now, describe to our listeners what a shotgun house is.
Basically, a real long house. You go in the front door, you're in the living room. Keep going straight back. You generally go into the middle room, which is the bedroom, and usually there's a bathroom off of that bedroom, and then you go on straight on back, and you're in the kitchen. And you go straight on back again, and you're out the backyard. Those houses were maybe 50 feet long, maybe 14 or 15 feet wide, and it was just really inefficient to heat them and cool them.
And those aren't really built anymore, are they?
Every now and then they are. Because if you take a house that's been torn down on a 25-foot lot, what are you going to put back there? Somebody will take and spend a fortune drawing up, having really nice plans drawn up for a big, nice house. And they'll get it done, and then they'll stick the furnace maybe in the attached garage or the water heater. If you're in a great big ranch that's maybe 2,000 square feet, 60-foot long, 30-foot deep, and your furnace is all the way on one end, and your water heater is all the way on one end, and your master bedroom's on the other. If you turn your bathroom sink on, and water has to travel 60 feet, how long do you think it's going to take it to get there? And how much hot water are you wasting? Same goes with heat and air, with your furnace. They should be built into the design of your house to make your house efficient. The furnace should be located as close to the central of the house as possible, and your water heater should be located as close as you can to your bathrooms and kitchens.
Describe the whole start-to-end process of building a home. I assume first you have to go out and find the land for it, and what's involved in that?
If you built a new house in the 1970s, decent house, might be 1,100 square feet, three bedroom, one bath. If somebody's building a new house today, you can go into all the new subdivisions around in the Louisville area. And the restrictions, most of them are, the smallest house you can build is, say, 1,800 square feet. If you build a one level, if you build a two level, it's 2,500 or 2,600 square feet. You know, it's not uncommon to find 3 and 3,200 square feet houses in these areas with basements. And I just couldn't go there. I've been involved in building a few of the nice houses with my cousin, who I mentioned was really good at building. It just wasn't me. I just thought, who needs that much house? So what I did, and I'm not the only one, there's other people that do the same thing. You look in the neighborhoods that you know. And that's the first thing, whether you're buying a house to rehab and rent, or buying a house to fix up and flip, or building a house, you need to know your area. I mean, you have to know the neighborhood as well as you possibly can. There's so much difference in neighborhoods as far as pricing goes, as far as renting goes, and that kind of thing. So you have to know your neighborhood. But what I would do is, a lot of neighborhoods built in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, would have maybe an extra lot where somebody had bought two lots. They lived there all their lives and maybe died or whatever, and then you could buy the extra lot. So I would look for those kind of lots. I would look for a house that had been in a fire and needed to be torn down. That's pretty much the way I found my lots. Almost every one of my houses are anywhere between 12 and, say, 1,400 square feet. Very seldom any bigger, almost never, usually around 1,200 square feet. And most of them are three-bedroom, bath and a half. I don't even go with the two full baths. I just do the bath and a half. I usually put a half bath in the master. And I usually don't do a basement. I usually do a crawl. It's just less expensive, and I'm not particularly fond of basements. And one of the things I decided when I started building or renting is that I wouldn't build or rent or own a house in a neighborhood I wouldn't live in myself, and in a house I wouldn't live in myself. So I built what suited me, what I liked. The house that I do build is pretty modest, pretty conservative. I don't do too many of the fancy stuff. Once in a while I might do a tray ceiling. I very seldom ever do a vault. I make them as plain as I can. I do the structure. I think that's the most important thing. And if you're building a house or if you're buying a house, you want a house that has a really good structure and a really good footprint, because you can't change those. I make sure that the footer's installed correctly. I usually help doing that. I have a brother that's in that business, so I'm there, but I usually don't do that. You got to make sure it's square level and all that. And then I want the framing of the house to be good, square level. Well, I mean, they don't have to be perfect. I mean, if you go to almost any new house and you start throwing a level or X-ing out the rooms, checking them for square, sometimes you'd be shocked at how unsquare and unlevel some of them are. That part doesn't really hurt a lot, but you still want it as best you can anyway. The main parts of the house, the plumbing, the electric, the heat and air, if you're going to put extra money in a house, there's where you want to put it. You want to put in a really good heat and air system. You want it sized right. You want it positioned right. That part of it's in the design of the house, the layout of the house, the cosmetics when you get to your drywall and your painting. Hell, you can repaint a house anytime you want. And most people, you know, most houses are probably repainted every 4 or 5 years. You know, they go in, they change the color in this room, the color in that room. Same with drywall. You put the drywall up. I try to do a decent job, get it in pretty good shape. You can always go back and smooth it out a little more later. If there's a spot that's not too good, resand, repaint. The things that you can't fix, that's the things that I'm mostly concerned about when I'm building the house for the first time. I enjoy it. And as you know, Michael, I used to be, back when computers had a C:\, I was into programming. Anybody who was a programmer, is a programmer, knows how you'll lay there as you're going to sleep and you'll get that whole program in your head and you'll run it through and through, try to catch the bugs in it and that kind of stuff. Well, I would do the same thing with a house plan. And I build about 3 or 4 different plans of houses. And all of them I've been designed myself. And mostly, I design them to fit the lot. I might get a lot that's 50 foot wide, which takes one plan. A 75 foot wide lot would take a different plan. I plan them to fit the lot. I'll be trying to fall asleep. I have the first house that I built. You know, it was great. I was real satisfied with it. But then, the next time I go to build a house, if I do this, if I move this, if I change this, it'll make it just a little bit better. And if you move one little thing in a house, you change the whole thing. You'll run that plan through your head and through your head, and sometimes it's hard to go to sleep at night. Finding the lot, getting the plan, and getting good subs, I mean, that is crucial. Because if you're a homeowner and you've got to put a heat and air system in your house, I would hate to be in that position because you don't know if you're getting screwed or not. You know you're probably paying too much. I always have a good plumber, a good heat and air man, and a good electrician, and I've had them for years. And I know they'll give me a really good price, and they'll do a really good job. I can trust them. That's real key. The rest of the house, I either do or help do, except for those three things, the plumbing, the electric, and the heat and air. I always sub those out. Because of the permits and things like that, it's just really, really hard to do it yourself, even if you wanted to. And the liability, especially in electric and heat and air, you just don't want to deal with that. The first little house I built when I lived on the farm, I used brick. But that's before I found out about vinyl siding. And I love vinyl siding. That's one of my favorite parts of building a house, is to do the vinyl siding. And I always do that myself. I usually don't even have anybody help me. And it's just incredibly relaxing to me. It's so simple. The siding is incredibly durable. Now, I don't paint, obviously. My cousin usually, or one of my family, will come in and do the painting for me. I do all my own trim work, hang all my doors, hang all my windows, and I usually either sub out the shingles or I'll get somebody that'll help me and I'll pack the shingles. Once you find the lot and it's in the location you want, you have your house plans, obviously. You have to go downtown and pull your building permit. To pull your building permit, you need not only a building permit, but usually you need your plan stamped by the highway department, by MSD, which is our sewer deal, and sometimes by the health department, depending on where it's at. So you get all that done. Then you're ready to start. You dig your footer, pour your foundation. Mine usually is a footer, which is concrete, with concrete blocks laid on top of it. Then your next deal is to get your lumber package, get your house framed. And the thing you try to do is you get your house framed as quick as possible, get your shingles on to what they call drying it in. So once it's dried in, What I do is try to finish the outside first. Once it's dried in, that means the windows and the doors are all hung. You've got your house wrap on and your shingles are on, so then I'll usually go in, vinyl side it, get your water lines dug, your gas lines dug if you have them, your sewer lines dug. You get all those guys in, get them inspected, get them covered up, and you get your lot leveled out. You usually go ahead and gravel your driveway so it can be settling, and you pour your driveway right on the end. But once the outside is pretty much done, then I go inside. Usually my plumber will come in first. He'll do what's called the rough plumbing. He'll run all the water lines and the sewer lines, set the tub and all that kind of thing. Once he's out of there, I'll bring in my electrician or my heat and air guy. Sometimes they'll swap. One of them will come in before the other, but those two guys go in and do their rough. All three of them will have to come back to do the finish. Then it's ready to be insulated. I do most of that myself. I'm real picky about my insulation in the walls. I use a extra thick insulation. I staple it. You know, I make sure around the windows, and you'd be surprised. You go into most new construction homes, and you go in there while they're being built. When your window sets in, you have a gap all the way around it, and you have to, by hand, go in there and put little pieces of insulation around that. A lot of builders don't even do it. They don't bother because they're not going to live there. Doesn't matter. So, you know, you've got an open space for air to come in every window you have. And I don't care if you've got the most expensive windows in the world. It's not going to matter if you don't have them properly insulated. Same with your doors, your attic, and all that stuff. Once my insulation's done, then it's ready normally to be drywalled. Sometimes I do sub out the drywall. I'll have somebody come in and I'll help them hang it. We'll hang it together, two or three of us will. And then I'll have somebody finish it for me. I usually don't do that. Then after that, it's ready for trim. I do the trim. I have somebody come in and paint it, hang the cabinets. I always put in my own cabinets. You can save a fortune by putting in your own cabinets. And kitchen cabinets can be a huge expense. And that's in a new house or if you're remodeling an older house. And the thing that people don't really understand about cabinets is that, you know, they'll say, well, you know, I'm getting custom cabinets or solid oak or solid hickory or solid whatever. Hey, there's no cabinets that are solid because the only thing that's solid on most cabinets is your front. The rest, the drawers and all that, they're not hickory or oak. They're usually made out of a particle board covered with a vinyl material or something like that. And that doesn't matter what you pay for your cabinets. So a lot of people, you know, believe if they get custom cabinets that they're getting something way structurally better than if you go out and buy cabinets and even custom cabinets. They don't bring all those cabinets in one piece. What they do is go in and measure out the kitchen where the cabinets are going, look at the design, and they'll bring in pieces like a 36-inch piece, a 60-inch piece, and they'll pin them together, screw them together. And so that's the same thing you can do with cabinets. The cabinets I buy are pre-finished, ready to hang. You can buy them in different widths from 9 inches, 12 inches, 15 inches, 18 inches, all the way up to 60 or 72 inches, and you simply measure out your area, and you buy the cabinets that fit, and you pin them together. You can do a pretty nice kitchen in the house as I build. The cabinets, if you hang them yourself, including the countertop, which I have a guy who makes those for me, the whole entire thing, probably $1,500, $1,600 for a pretty nice kitchen, pretty nice set of cabinets. You know, I usually use the same color cabinets, same color paint, all that kind of stuff in the houses. Same color vinyl. That's why I usually don't build houses next to each other. That way you don't have two identical houses right beside of each other. Once your cabinets are done, you have your plumber, heat and air, electric guy come back in, do their finish work. Then you're ready to drop your carpet or your linoleum or whatever inside there. Then you're ready to finish your driveway, pour your driveway, and boom. And during this process, you have all kinds of inspections. You have your rough plumbing inspection, your rough electrical inspection. You have your finished heat and air inspection. You have your rough framing inspection. Then you have your final inspections, or 8 total. And then you have what's called the final inspection, where they'll give you a certificate of occupancy. Once you get that, you're ready to go.
Now, I assume that varies different parts of the country. It seems like there's certain communities where you can almost do whatever you want.
In rural areas, you can.
No matter what vocation we're in, we all need tools to get our work done. What would we find in your set of got to have tools, and how much would it cost if you had to replace it?
There are different tools, obviously, for different jobs. Most of the tools are the same. When I'm doing vinyl siding, part of vinyl siding is your part of your house has aluminum on it, and you bend that aluminum. Now, that takes what's called a break. Now, that's a pretty expensive tool. That's probably $1,100 or $1,200. But I only take it out and use it the day I need it. I bring it back home and store it in my garage. 200 or 300 pounds and a little bit aggravating to move around. Besides that, skill saw, sawzall, tape measures. I use a Stanley anti-vibe 22-ounce hammer. I get teased about it. Most framers use a 28-ounce hammer, and I use a little smaller one. I have guys always telling me I'm using a girl's hammer, but it works for me. If I accidentally hit my thumb, I'd rather hit it with a 22-ounce hammer than a 28. But the tools themselves are really not that expensive, and a construction site is incredibly hard on basic tools. Not only do you lose them pretty often, tape measures, they go through hell on a job site. You'll hang them on something and bend them. You'll have them land in the wrong place when you're using a skill saw and cut through them. Chalk lines you constantly break. I use a chop box to do my cutting. I use a skill saw some. A skill saw, you freehand cut and follow a line. A chop box, I'll take my board, measure where I need to cut, and I'll either mark it with a small nail or with a little notch with a utility knife, and then that way I line it up under the blade, and once I get it lined up, move my finger out of the way and drop the blade. Those things can run anywhere from $200 to $400, $500, depending on, you know, what you want to spend, and I usually pack that back and forth with me. I have very little trouble with tools stolen or things bothered on a job site. Knock on wood, I'm building in existing subdivisions. So most of the time, there is a person who lives on both sides of my house that I'm building. And I always, you know, try to buddy up to those people, not just selfishly, but I don't want to do anything. A construction site is a nasty, messy place. So I don't want to do anything to, you know, interrupt their lives if I don't have to. I don't want to be using tools after it gets dark, which I like to do. So I have to watch myself. I like to work late. So you've got somebody watching your house most of the time. In a regular new subdivision, you know, you may have 40 or 50 houses going up at one time, nobody living there. People who are interested in thieving would go to a place like that to look.
You finish the home, and then it's time to decide, are you going to sell it or are you going to lease it?
Right now, I am the owner slash manager of about 10 single-family rental houses. I've owned a couple of fourplexes and a few apartments like that. I just don't care for it. I like the single-family. I own a couple of them in partnership with my uncle, who, again, is the guy that got me started in it. The new ones, a lot of times, I will option them to the tenant who's moving in. In other words, rent with the option to buy. Fairly often, a tenant will buy one of my new houses. When they do, then I frantically get searching for a lot and replace that home. I am not a big-time builder or even a big-time landlord. No way. I don't want to be. 10 houses is enough to manage for me. I never got into houses thinking, you know, that I'm going to get rich and get rich quick.
You finish the home, and you said you lease at first and then give them the option to buy. And I think there's a logic to that, right? That lets you have the home in your possession for a little bit of time to maybe resolve any issues?
There are several reasons I do it, Michael. If I take and buy a used home or an existing home, I rehab it, fix it up, flip it, sell it. Basically, I sign a disclosure sheet, which is by law in most states now, saying what's wrong with that house. What I know is wrong with that house. And since I haven't lived there, I probably don't know much anyway. Once I do that, and if I'm totally honest on that disclosure sheet, that is an as-is sale. Once those people buy that house, it's theirs. There is no warranties or coming back on those type homes. On new construction, it's different. If you build a new construction house and you sell it right after you build it, most of the time it's a year you have to warranty it. And in reality, it's up to 10 years that in some states they can come back and say, well, this messed up, which doesn't happen very often, but you can. That's one of the reasons I like to option my houses. You might call me a control freak. I want to maintain control of something. When I sell it, I still have the responsibility of the house, but I don't own it anymore. Now, I have sold new ones straight out like that and have had no trouble, but I still like to maintain control of the house because if there's a problem with the house, I don't want somebody else to have it. I want to be the one that still owns it. And whether it can be fixed or not, which I've never had a problem that was major and couldn't be fixed, but you never know. It could happen. The other reason is it's a huge tax advantage because if I build a house or I remodel a house, buy a house, remodel it, sell it, or I build a house and sell it, then the income from what I make on that house is earned income. In other words, it's taxed just like your public job. If you take a house, whether you rehab it and rent it, or whether you rent option a house or just plain rent a new construction house, and let's say 2 years later I sell either one, and you can even do it in a year, then no longer is that considered earned income. It's considered capital gain. or like investment income. It would be considered just like if you had a CD in the bank and how you count your interest at the end of the year on that CD. You don't count that as earned income. And the difference is probably where capital gains is 15% of profits, earned income can be 36%, 37%. So it's a huge tax advantage. There's the two main reasons that I prefer to option as opposed to sell.
Now, a lot of people assume buying a new home means it's free of any defects. So what are some things that are likely to go wrong in the first year or two?
Most of the time, it's not much. Any house you build, and I don't care if you do a super job on the foundation or you do everything perfect, most houses will settle to a certain extent. If a house settles evenly, doesn't matter, you don't even know it as a homeowner or as a home builder as far as that goes. But if they settle a little uneven, one end of the house was on clay and the other end of the house was on slate, then maybe some of the doors will shift a little bit, need to be readjusted, the interior doors or the outside doors. Maybe the furnace doesn't work exactly, even though it's a new construction or a brand new furnace, you know, one of the rooms just doesn't cool or doesn't heat. Usually nothing major. Now, it can be, and if a roof leaks and or a pipe bust, that's probably the ultimate nightmare of most of us guys who rent or own houses, is that nobody will be home, be at work. A copper line that didn't get soldered correctly in a wall will just bust loose, and you've got all that water running in that house. And I mean, it can literally destroy a house. And obviously, insurance takes care of most of that. That's still your responsibility. It was your house, and obviously there was a flaw because the pipe came loose. Those kind of things mostly happen in the first few months of the new house. Once, you know, your plumbing system has been operating and working pretty good for a few months, you almost don't have to worry. You usually don't have a problem there. But those are some of the things.
When leasing, what do you do to ensure you have good tenants that aren't going to come in and destroy the property or just decide they're not going to pay and then you have to endure the cost of getting them out of there?
A couple of my rules for renting a house. Okay, first off, I never put a sign in the yard for rent. Just don't do it. I never rent to friends of friends, that kind of thing, or family. Just don't do it. I've never done it, and if I would avoid it if I could. I advertise in the Sunday paper. I usually put it in just one time, and I never actually meet the people who call. I'll talk to them over the phone, and if they're interested in looking at the house, I'll leave the house unlocked that Sunday afternoon. I might get 40 calls in the first two or three hours sometimes. Because most of the time I'm renting a new construction home in an area that almost has no new construction. So they're pretty desirable, and that's another reason I like to build in older neighborhoods, because you have something that's a little bit unique. Once they actually call, and I talk to them over the phone, and I go over some of the stuff with them, I tell them what I'm looking for. I tell them to go look at the house. It's unlocked. So they'll go, they'll take a look, and if they're interested, I tell them to call me back. I have a real simple application I fill out over the phone. I never meet the people in person, not at this time. By early in the Sunday afternoon, I have as many applications as I want. So then I'll just put a message on my answering machine, house is rented, and I don't answer it anymore. So what I would do with those applications, I want to know who they are, how many is going to be living in the house and who they are, what their source of income is, if they're on Social Security or if they are working and where they're working. The most important thing for me, you know, once all of that stuff's settle down, is rent reference. I am looking for a professional renter. I'm not looking for a gypsy. I'm looking for someone who is going to move into my house, again, if I'm pure renting, but I'm looking for someone who is going to move in my house and going to take care of it and going to stay there. So that verifiable rent reference is so important. I don't do background checks. It can't be their Uncle Joe they rented from. It's got to be mostly an apartment complex, that kind of thing that's verifiable and they've lived there a few years. But I go through those applications. I don't want to rent, if I can help it, to somebody who's got six or seven kids. I just don't do it. Just like I wouldn't rent to somebody who had six or seven animals. I do allow pets. And the reason I do that is most of the time, a person who's going to rent, they're going to rent a single family house. One of the big reasons is because they have a pet. So I allow a cat, a medium-sized dog. I don't rent to people that have four Rottweilers, but just an average pet, I don't charge any more for it. Most of my tenants have a pet. I've got tenants that I've had 19 years. Most of the 10 that I'm managing right now, most of them have the original tenants. Once I do get a tenant, I take care of them. I make a good business relationship with them. I mean, I don't become their friend. That's not what you do, because it's a contract between me.
Right, then they have unrealistic expectations.
And believe me, I've done all of this wrong, so I know not to do it anymore. I never call or go to somebody's house and ask them for rent. I just don't do it. That rent is supposed to be at my house by a certain date. And if it's not there by that date, they get a letter. And if it's not there in 10 days after that, then they'll get an eviction notice. In the last, say, 10 years, I've never had to evict anybody. The first few years, I actually paid a couple of people to move out. You just create that business relationship with them. And you let them know, because a lot of tenants think that if something's wrong, they call me, that I'll get mad and raise the rent. I want them to call me. If there's a plumbing problem, call me. And if they call me, I'm there now, and I take care of it. I believe that's why I have tenants that have been there for years and years and years. It works well. When I said I'm looking for a professional tenant or someone who wants to rent, urban versus country, there is such a different attitude as far as renting in an urban area. In Louisville, you will find a lot of people who don't want to own a house. In a country setting, you'll find a lot of people, the country attitude is, just as soon as I can, dude, I'm going to buy me a house or I'm going to own my place, even if it's a trailer. Mostly what you have in a rural area, or you have more of, people who rent because they can't do anything else. So you get a whole lot more, really, what I call bummy renters in areas like that. So it's harder to rent in a country setting than it is in an urban area.
See, now, most people would assume the opposite, that an urban area would be people who don't care. But again, that's issues of choosing the neighborhood.
You get a good rent reference. And if you feel uncomfortable about the rent reference, you know, I'll call it, talk to the manager or whoever. Most apartment managers will be straight up with you 100%. And if they've got a tenant that's been there, and a lot of mine were, you know, maybe rented in the same complex 5, 6, 7 years, that's the kind of people I want, because they've always paid the rent. I don't care if they filed bankruptcy. I don't care if they haven't paid their credit cards, in the habit of paying their rent and taking care of their place. I don't bother a person once they've moved into my house. I leave them alone. But I do have people who, my uncle or, you know, one of my brothers, or who would drive by every so often. And if that house looks like it's not been taken care of outside, almost always, what's on the outside is what's on the inside.
Exactly.
So if you see a house that's neat on the outside, it's probably neat on the inside. One of my family members has gone by and says, man, it looks rough out there. The yard's grass is real tall. I don't put up with that. Most of the tenants I have take way better care of my house that they're renting from me than I do the one I live in. I want to keep certain houses. I don't know why, but certain ones you get attached to. On an option, basically the difference is, and you'll hear a lot of bad things about optioning a house, because landlords or people like me take advantage of people through options. When I rent a house, let's say the rent's $700, the deposit might be $750. On an option, you're setting the price of that house, and then you're creating a contract with that individual. If they buy this house within 24 months, and that's usually what I do, a two-year option, then you can have this house for, let's say, $105,000. For that privilege, they will put up at least $3,000. Most of the time, it's around $4,000. So they are, in effect, risking their $4,000. Most or a lot of landlords, they do that knowing the individual is not going to buy the house. They do it because at the end of the year, and they'll mostly do a year lease or year option. At the end of the year, they get to keep the $4,000, boom, it's over. I don't do that. The $4,000 is insurance to me if I have a problem or they tear something up. It's just a little extra money that insures me a little better. But if the person at the end of the 2 years doesn't buy the house, they at least get half of their option money back. And sometimes more than that. Depends on the tenant. I have been known to give most of it back or all of it back. And most of the time, when I have a tenant who doesn't exercise an option, they stay. Maybe their credit didn't get cleaned up and they can't buy it. I have a couple of those right now that are 6- and 7-year tenants, whether it's my option houses or my rental houses. Another thing I don't do is almost never do I raise the rent. In an area where an average house like I'm renting would rent for $750, I will rent it for, say, 6 and a quarter, maybe $100 under. There's two things it does. It gets you more better quality tenants interested in it. And I have buddies. They were more interested in how much they got per month than how much you get per year. In an area it would rent for $750, they might say, well, hell, I can get $800 out of it. Sure they can. But the quality renter they get may come in there, pay the first 2 months, and then, boom, not pay the next three. And by that time you've kicked them out, you've lost 3 months, you got to go and fix the house. So how much money did you get at the end of the year? That's what counts on a rental. I don't think I've lost a single month's rent in probably 7 or 8 years. That's what I strive for with this Carlton Sheet stuff. And believe me, years ago I bought the Carlton Sheet stuff. Carlson Sheets was a great speaker. But most of the stuff he said, or a lot of stuff he said, was bull. There was some good information in there, but they kept talking about cash flow, cash flow, cash flow. A house makes you money when it's paid for. If you, say, got it on a 15-year or 10-year, if you can, if you can just get that rent to pay the house off, you're doing great. You're not going to have cash flow, almost never, on a decent house if you've borrowed the money.
So how much now, do your homes you build generally sell for, and kind of what is your cost?
I'm about to go crazy because I can't find a lot I want right now. I get anxious when I'm not at least building or drawing a plan. The last house I built, including the lot, I had probably 16 or 17, and it was a great deal. You make your money at the buy. You don't make your money when you sell it. You make your money when you purchase or build it, because the amount you got in it is what counts. It's a 1,240 square foot, three-bedroom, bath and a half. Got a nice driveway. It does not have a garage. I put in high-efficiency heat pump in this one, and I do prefer the heat pumps over the gas, and so most of the time anymore, that's what I'm doing. The house, I probably had about $55,000 in the house, $56,000, something like that. So I had about $75,000 in the house. It's probably $110,000, $115,000. I'd probably clear $110,000 on it. You're talking about maybe $35,000. You can make money in houses, and you do, but it's not a get-rich-quick scheme. It's like anything else. You get out of it what you put in, and you plan it for the long term, or it's not going to work.
So what should we look for if we want to purchase a home? How did you go up and size up these homes that you bought, even the fixer-uppers that you know you had to put some work into?
If you just want to buy a house for yourself, there's foreclosures, which is what I used to do a lot of, me and my cousin Bobby and my brother and my uncle. We bought a lot of foreclosures. That's risky. It really is. And we were lucky. We never actually got burnt. When you go to buy a foreclosure, basically you're buying at the courthouse steps. A lot of times when you buy that house, you can't get in it before you bid on it. So you're at the auction. It's not literally the courthouse steps in Louisville. It's a room in the old jailhouse there. You go in there and you're bidding on it. If you get it, you're allowed 10 days that the courthouse can give you a clear title. If it has a clear title, it's your baby. So if you get in there and instead of needing $20,000 worth of work you thought, it needs $50,000, too bad, so sad. That's one of the riskier ways of doing it, and I've got a couple of the best deals I've ever done from foreclosures. People think, well, if I go out and I find a for sale by owner, you know what, that's probably the worst way in the world to buy a house. I'm not saying you can't get a good deal that way, but most of the time, from my experience, what I found when it's for sale by owner, it's for sale by owner because realtors don't want to mess with it. They want too much for it. I've found that over and over and over again. Using a good quality realtor to find you a house that somebody needs to sell quick, you can get a good deal that way. And the same with bank-owned property. When I first started buying foreclosures 20 years ago, here in Louisville, they sell every 2 weeks, every other Tuesday. When I first started buying in Jefferson County, they were selling about 40 houses every 2 weeks. And probably 20 or 25 of those houses every 2 weeks were going to people like me. The rest of them, the banks were buying them back. And this is hard to believe, but today there's about probably an average of 150 selling every 2 weeks. But the difference is about 90% of them are going back to banks. The banks are just buying them back. What I call REOs, bank-owned properties. When the bank gets them back, gets the title clear and all that, they'll hand them over to a realtor. So REOs, you can get those through realtors. And if you look at the listings or you're working with a realtor and just ask her to email you or send you links to all the REOs in areas you want, that's a good way to buy a decent house. But one of the better ways for a homeowner is through HUD. There is a website, bidselect.com. Any FHA loan that goes bad, and a huge number of the houses that have mortgages on them that go bad are FHA loans. You know, that's real common. If it's an FHA loan, and basically that means that the government insured the loan for the bank who loaned the money, then the government gets that house back. So HUD contracts with bidselect.com. You can go to that website, and you can search by state, you can search by county, you can search by zip code. In Jefferson County right now, HUD has maybe 50 houses for sale in Jefferson County. When they first come up, they will be owner-occupant only. So they'll be listed there, and you have to go through a realtor again to look at them, and that's fine. I mean, you need a pro, and I use a realtor. If I'm selling a house, I don't sell it myself. If I'm buying a house, most of the houses I buy, unless it's a foreclosure, I buy through a realtor. I mean, she finds them for me. The same with the lots. On HUD, it'll get listed, and then within 10 days, the bids close, and you have to be someone who is willing to live there in order to bid. I actually have bought maybe three houses that way, some of the best deals I ever got, and would buy the house, move in it, and live there for 2 or 3 years, and then sell it and move on to the next one. But it's a great way to buy a house. Again, you have to be careful. You should never buy a house unless you have it inspected by a good home inspector. Sometimes I'll use somebody else to come in and inspect it. Sometimes I've used a paid inspector before, and it's $200 to $350. It's well worth it to find out, not that the house is going to be perfect, but the actual condition of the house. Once you bid on that house through HUD, you get the house. They sometimes will have an escrow on them. Let's say the house is listed for $75,000 with a fix-up escrow of $5,000. So you close on that house, and again, you have to get your financing. Some of them are FAA insurable, and some of them are not. It'll say on the listing. Once you buy that house, if it has an escrow with an FHA insurable escrow, you fix that house up and you will be refunded with your receipts that $5,000. So basically, if you bought the house for $75,000, you spent $5,000 on it, you get that $5,000 back. But you can really get a good deal through HUD. And then sometimes I buy houses through estate auctions. You can get some decent deals that way too.
Talk about how you stay on top of all your paperwork, records, billing, and just ordering all your supplies and your permits.
If you're in this business, if you don't keep good records, you won't be in this business long, because you have to know, not only for taxes, you have to know when a house is profitable. You have to know that at the end of the year, house A brought you in so much rent, you paid so much in taxes, so much in insurance, and you spent so much on repairs. You will once in a while get a house, seems like something breaks in it all the time. If you keep great records, you know. I use Quicken, actually use an old version of Quicken, 2002. It works pretty good. When I'm building a house, I simply go into Microsoft Word, and while I'm building that house, I keep a daily record. I write the date down, what I spent that day, when I buy something, what I bought, what I paid for it, and who I bought it from. That way, I can go back to any house that I've ever built and pull up that Word document, usually 6 or 7 pages, and I can arrow key down, and if I had a guy come out and lay my block, I'll have his name in there and his number, and I add that kind of detail to it and what I paid him. It's an incredible reference. You have a specific checkbook for that rental company. If money comes in, it goes in there. If money comes out, it goes out of there. And so it's so easy to do my taxes. Print reports out of Quicken, go to my tax person, and boom, you know, in 2 hours we got them done and I'm out of there. Detailed records are real, real important. I'll use the internet if I'm looking for a better window, or I'm trying to find a high-efficiency, really good water heater. I'm trying to find information on anything like that. I'm always wanting to make my house a little better, a little more efficient.
What role, if any, and I ask this because I notice most people I know doing construction, it's kind of a husband and wife affair. Maybe the guy's great at his craft, but doesn't have the business savvy like you do. So I'm curious, what role, if any, does your wife play in the business?
She helps me. You know, whenever I need a sighted person, my computer locks up. She's constantly there. She does a lot of times enter my records. I can do it myself, but she does them sometimes to get permits. You have to draw a site plan. So she does all that. We'll sit down at the table. First thing she'll say, you're not going to holler at me this time, are you? You've got that picture in your mind of what you want them to draw, and you can't explain it to them. So you're really hollering at yourself, not them. That's what I try to tell her, but she don't go for it. I guess it's real important to have somebody that agrees with what you're doing. She has her life. She works in computers and has her job, and she's gone 10, 12 hours a day, every day, you know, through the week. So she has all of her stuff to do. But if I need her, she's there, and it makes a big difference. And I mentioned my uncle. A long time ago, he told me, if you get 5 houses, once they're paid for, you'll have a check for every week of the month, plus one extra one to pay for expenses. You're not making any money those first 15 years. But once they're paid off, I mean, you've got several thousand dollars a month coming in for the rest of your life if you've got good quality houses. Because if you buy your house with good structure, you know, it's a good, solid house, it's not about ready to fall down, and you maintenance it and take care of it, then you've got an income for the rest of your life. And I promise you, it's a hell of a lot better than Social Security. I mean, you work your whole life for your Social Security. And what are you going to get, $1,200, $1,300, $1,400 a month? Nobody can live on that anymore. He was so right in the fact that, you know, with a little bit of effort, especially if you're young, if you're 25, by the time you're 40, if things go right, you've got a big part of your retirement taken care of. And not just your retirement. From 40 on, if a person happens to be on Social Security disability income, whether you're blind or whatever other disability, that rental income does not count as earned income against your check. For for someone who just wants one rental house to have a little more income to supplement their disability Social Security. You could be bringing in $5,000 a month income, and it wouldn't affect your Social Security disability at all, except for maybe paying a little tax on it.
Well, a lot of great information here, Jerry. Why don't you give your contact information if anyone would like to speak with you further about anything that you've talked about
today. And if anybody, I have a Braille measuring tape, but it's pretty chintzy. But my wish list would be for a good, they don't make, as far as I know, a good quality Braille tape measure, like a Stanley Fat Max that you can go to Home Depot and get, or a level that is an audible level that will beep on horizontal and vertical without going to, you know, getting one of those little pieces of junk at Home Depot that it takes somebody with 20/20 to set up and do. If anybody has tools or done this kind of work and has things that have worked for them, I'd love to know about it. And anybody can email me at jwmenzie, at insightbb.com. I'd love to hear from people. I would love to get any information that anybody has or give any information I have to anybody. As you can tell, once I get talking, it's hard to shut me up.
Yeah, you're definitely passionate about your craft, and that's what we're looking for when we do these interviews, is people that really get into their trade and are willing to take the time and explain it, because I think it's important for people, either young folks trying to decide what to do in the future, or maybe people in midlife deciding to go into a new career, just for people to know that these options are out there. I think it's very important. So I want to thank you.
I totally agree, Michael.
I want to thank you a lot, Jerry, for taking an hour or so to talk with us today. And I know many people will be interested in it. Good luck with your endeavors. Who knows? Maybe you'll get a renter or a new home buyer out of this. We do have a lot of
listeners. You never know. I take any advantage I can get.
Very good. Thanks a lot, sir.
Thanks, Michael.
I am very excited today on this August 28, 2009, because today is an evolution for assistive technology. It's the release of Apple's Snow Leopard 10.6 for the Macintosh computer. And with this new operating system comes a variety of enhancements to their voice over screen reading software that is built in. Yes, you do not pay one extra cent. Everyone gets it. And if you walk up to a computer owned by a sighted person, you, by simply pressing Command F5, have the ability to listen to that computer and use it just as they do. Today we're going to do an install. I have two guests with me today, two people who have gone before me and have already installed the latest Snow Leopard, to talk about what we can expect, as well as some of the new features that they've found so far. Keep in mind, this is just the first day, so we're just now getting under the hood. But joining me today is Jesse Hernandez in Miami, Florida. Thanks for joining me today.
Hello,
Jesse.
Sir. Thank you very much for having me, Mr. Loft.
No problem. And Scott Rakowski from down under, or up over, just outside of Sydney, Australia. Hello, Scotty.
Good to be here, and very excited, like yourself, about the features in Snow Leopard there.
As you say, yeah, man. And of course, Australians.
Yeah,
got it a day ahead of the U.S. because it was Friday there, at least 14 hours earlier than it was in the States. You can do a fresh install where it totally erases and reformats the hard drive. And there's a second option where you can back up everything just in case something goes afoul. And of course, most people can simply just do the real simple default install, and within about 40 minutes, upgrade their system from the current 10.5 Leopard to 10.6 Snow Leopard. So I'm going to insert the disc, and that's going into my iMac, and we'll hear it talking shortly, and we'll talk about what's on here. There is a getting started manual of sorts, right? Have you read that, Jesse? Is there anything there?
No, I've actually haven't. I've looked at a little bit of it, but not the whole thing.
I read the first couple of pages. It was not that interesting, but it's worth a read anyway.
Optional installs, selected folder. Instructions, selected folder. Optional installs, select install Mac OS X.app, selected application.
Tell our users here what they need to do.
The option that you are looking at there, which is install Mac OS X.app, is the main app utility that you're going to use to install Snow Leopard. And the optional installs folder, it is a Xcode toolkit, which is like a programming language that Apple uses. So what you're going to want to do is you want to run the Mac OS X install. You're going to go through a wizard, and it's going to guide you on how to install it.
Okay, so I'll do that now. We will press the Command O.
Open. Install Mac OS X.app. Install Mac OS 10. Window. Install Mac OS 10. Utilities. Button. To set up the installation of Snow Leopard, click Continue. Go back. Dim button. Continue button. Press continue button. Interact with dialog for window. Install Mac OS X. English.
That's the Apple license agreement.
Software license agreement for Mac OS X single use, family pack, and Leopard upgrade licenses for use on Apple branded systems. Save button. Disagree button. Agree button. Press agree. Dial. Closing dialog.
Go to the beginning.
Mac. Install Mac OS X. Mac OS X will be installed on Macintosh HD. Image. Macintosh HD. Customize button. Go back button. Install button.
Customize button.
I just took the defaults and everything seems to have worked. It just has like printer support, language support, and Rosetta. But I just think for most people, just click install unless you want to go and turn the options off.
Would you recommend making any changes in there, Jesse?
If you want to make your install as small as possible, you can uncheck unless if you need printer driver support, additional fonts. I just unchecked all of that stuff.
Don't look like they took up that much size. I listened to Scott last night, and as I recall, Scott, none of them were really large.
Nah, they weren't huge.
You can go with the default.
Just explain to people if they're having trouble with their Mac and they need to do a complete fresh install and they need to go into the disk utility. Explain that process.
It's 7:30.
When you started the program, there was a utility button.
Yes.
You click that, and there you can format your hard drive. It'll open up like a instance of disk utility on the disk, and you can format your drive, prepare it if you want to do a clean install, because by default, what it'll do is it'll do what is called an archive and install. But if you want to start fresh, you're going to have to format that drive, and then it'll let you do a clean install.
How much time does that add? Have you done it or heard from people who've done it both ways to know how much time does it add?
It's a while. It can take sometimes up to 2 hours.
Whereas what we're going to do, the default install is going to take about 40 minutes on average, depending upon the speed of your
40, 50 minutes, because what it does, according to what I've heard, it'll copy a large chunk of data to the hard drive off of the CD first. Then when it reboots, it will use some of that chunk that it got from the CD, and it'll install it where it has to go. Now, have you done updates already to Leopard?
Yes, I have updated every, as far as I know, everything is updated. All of the system updates, as well as all of my applications that I'm aware of, have all been updated. So why don't we go ahead and start the install, and then we'll talk about some of the other things that people need to do.
All right.
Install button. Go back. Install button. Press install. Interact with dialog. Alert. Are you sure you want to install Mac OS X? Click install to quit all open applications and install Mac OS X Snow Leopard on Macintosh HD. Click install to quit all cancel but install button. Press install button. Authentication. Window. Secure edit text.
Now it's asking for your password.
Install Mac OS X.
Which is your administration password on your Mac.
And the DVD has begun to whirl. Now what we saw last night when Scott's installed, it would speak up to about the point of 20% of the install, at which point it asked to reboot the computer. And we had to wait a couple of minutes before we could hit Command F5, and then at that point get speech from the disk with a different voice, the Fred, I guess, that you get on the disk. And at that point, it was about 25%, and we had speech during the entire install, other than that few minutes. Very impressive. You could kind of check where things were, at least as far as time remaining.
About 57 minutes.
Okay, so it's saying about 57 minutes. I think it'll adjust down a little bit from that. So now let's talk about some of the things I did in advance that everyone should do just in case something doesn't go as it should. One thing I heard was to actually back up your users folder to like an external drive. And I also backed up my applications folder, but I'm not sure what the exact recommendations are. Would you like to comment on that, Jesse?
Back up all of your applications, save any serial numbers that you've got. Save any keys, because you might have to put that in again when you do your install. I'm saying maybe. It's always good to exercise regular backup routines as a resort, more so when you're doing an install.
Yes, because you never know, something could be corrupted. It's going to work for most people, but you might be one of those that is in the exception category. And I know there were definitely issues between Tiger and Leopard, and I think a lot of those were addressed here to make this a smoother transition for most people. Not only do you have speech and the ability as a totally blind person to do this install from scratch, even if you have to rebuild your computer with nothing, but there's also software that lets you back it up and even boot from an external drive, all of which is accessible. A couple applications one that we've talked about and used called Super Duper, another one called Carbon Copy Cloner. And what I want to ask you about, Jesse, is Time Machine. This is something built into Apple. And I spoke with a lady last night and I said, do you have everything backed up? And she said, I have a Time Machine copy. And I'm curious, is that adequate for making this transition?
I've heard people that are able to browse the Time Machine timeline. I myself haven't had to do it. I do have a Time Machine backup, which I'm actually thinking of clearing out and doing another one, fresh copy. Another thing that I like is that if she has done a Time Machine backup and she has to migrate from that backup, she can do that with the Migration Wizard. So she can bring all of her stuff back from that backup.
That's why I wanted to get clarification. You could not use it to go back to Leopard, whereas if you had something like Carbon Copy Cloner or Super Duper, you could actually boot on an external drive and restore it if for some reason you wanted to.
Carbon Copy Cloner clones an exact image of your drive. What I believe Time Machine does, it'll back it up. I don't believe it's a bootable image.
No, it's not. If you boot off the Snow Leopard DVD and go into, I think it's under Utilities, I think there's actually Restore Time Machine Backup, so you could, in theory, restore back to Leopard if you had to. If you had a full Time Machine backup. I think having the clone backup of either Super Duper or Carbon Copy Cloner is the way to go, because you can actually boot off the external drive and then do a restore from the external drive back onto the hard disk if you had to.
Is there anything else that we need to be mindful of before we begin?
One thing I'm going to warn everybody, if you do have to restore, keep in mind that your mail folder is going to be converted over to Snow Leopard. So once you do that, and you have Leopard on another drive or something, that mail folder is not going to work in Leopard.
If you have your user's directory backed up, that would contain your mail folder, right? And you need to manually bring that back.
Yes, you're going to have to manually bring that back. If you're going to do a clone of Leopard, and you're going to be restoring from that clone, you will lose all of your email that you had in Snow Leopard, because they won't be compatible with each other. Apparently, they've done some changes to the database structure, and they convert the email for you.
Okay, let's see where we are with status.
About 52 minutes.
Next lineup will give you the percentage.
9.1% progress indicator.
There you go, 9.1%. Let's talk about some of the new, the cool stuff that we're finding out. And then we talked about one change is improved help for new users to voice over. When you leave your cursor over something for a while, it actually speaks some context help to help you understand what to do next, right?
Yes, it will. It'll say, for instance, you are in a edit area. If you're in a progress area, you're in a text element to read, use your voiceover keys, but you're really in a progress bar. But you'll know that because you're going click, 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 so you'll know. Little things like that, you know, it'll just give you like a hint, you know, to say, you're in a table. If you want to interact with it, you have to do this.
And we mentioned a change in the key to know. Very important is VO H. That gives you a lot of specific help for voiceover. And users who don't know what VO is, that's a combination of pressing the control and option keys. The option key would be analogous to what you have in Windows. It's your start key, or on the right side would be your context Windows key. Talk about the browser support. You have these abilities to bookmark parts of the screen now, which I think is just fascinating.
Auto hotspots. There are certain parts of the screen that are bookmarked, and you can actually browse to them. You can also make some yourself in the web while you're browsing web pages. They're kind of like the hotspots that you can create in Leopard already, but they're more for like the internet.
So say if you go to a newspaper, you can highlight the sports section and different things that you regularly go to, saving you time to traverse to that area. A lot of people, especially in Windows, have issues with Skype. And you said that now you have the ability to label controls and have labeled a bunch of buttons in Skype for the Mac.
When you hit VO slash on a button that's not labeled, what Apple has done, they've given developers the ability of putting what are called help tags in their applications, which is like kind of like a tooltip in Windows. If you gain access to that tooltip, and let's say it says button, and you're like, oh, what is this? You hit Volt Shift N to read the context of the tag. And then when you read the tag, you can hit Volt Slash and simply put a label like, let's say, call phone. And you know that that button, when you click it, it's going to probably bring up the dial pad or something for Skype, you know, just as an example.
Right. And you said these can even be shared. So when someone really maps out Skype, they could in turn ultimately share that with anyone who wants to copy to the appropriate place and basically make their Skype read just like yours. Is that correct?
Yes, you can. From what I've understood. I'm going to look
further. This is our first day, folks. So we're right. It's our first day. So we've read about these things, but we have yet to really do them and see exactly how to implement them and exactly how they work. Talk about the customization of hotkeys. Apparently, you can make hotkeys to do almost anything now.
Restarting.
There we go.
Okay, so there's a restart. We're going to assume that's about 20%. And it's going to boot in the DVD. And we saw last night, Scott, I believe you said you timed it.
Yeah, about 5 minutes after the DVD spun up again. Then when you do the Command F5, it took a bit for VoiceOver to start. So give it time. Don't just rush it and keep hitting it all the time. So yeah, you hit Command F5 and then it'll load it off the DVD and it'll say VoiceOver on when it's ready to go, which you'll hear in the next 5 minutes when we do it here.
What are some things you found? You've been playing with it for about a day now. What are some things you like and things you maybe you're a little thrown by it right now?
Well, basically, the first thing I found as soon as I'd done a restart of the machine and heard the cool welcome music, and it said that if you wanted to not learn about VoiceOver, if you already knew how to use it, press V for Victor, or you could press the space bar if you wanted the tutorial on how to use VoiceOver getting started and things like that. As soon as I finished and hit V for Victor, I immediately noticed that my FN or function F12 and F11 were not adjusting my volume on my MacBook, couldn't work out why, and realized that the option that says use F1 to F12 hardware function keys was not checked under keyboard in system preferences. So that kind of threw me for a few minutes trying to work out why.
So tell our users how to fix that.
Basically, you have to go to system preferences, keyboard. I also did notice when I went to reactivate my iTunes account, because one thing I did here before doing the upgrade was to deactivate the iTunes from your computer just in case something went wrong.
iTunes and Audible if you use it, right?
Yeah, and Audible. When I went to reauthorize my computer with iTunes, when I was typing in the password box, you get little clicks now, which is as before, you get nothing at all. So you didn't know whether the characters were being accepted or anything like that. So that was really cool. I was really over the moon about that. When you delete characters now by pressing the backspace, the pitch of the voice is very low. Like it goes E, B, C, D. So you know that the characters are being deleted. Very, very cool feature.
It is on the keyboard preference pane. It's the first tab. So right when you get in there, you just Volt right a little bit and you'll hear use F1, F12 checkbox.
And it's got to be checked. That's the first thing I ended up doing because I couldn't work out why I couldn't actually use any of the normal function keys.
You walk up to a new computer for the first time. You're getting your new Mac. You know to hit Command F5. You got the speech on. But there's a couple other settings that you want to adjust for optimum performance so VoiceOver is truly tracking what's going on the screen. What are some of those initial changes that you might want to make?
By default, the cursor tracking is on. You toggle it with Volt Shift F3, and it will say cursor tracking on, cursor tracking off. Having it on is the best way to begin with.
And there are some times as you use the computer that you want to turn that off.
I normally only turn it off in the iTunes store, because if you leave it on, sometimes your cursor jumps out of the web area of the store, and then you've got to go back there and start interacting with the store again. And so I just find turning it off is good.
I believe they fixed it. I was just browsing the store. I wasn't really buying anything, but I was just browsing and clicking on links, and it's fast.
Talk about VoiceOver, what the configurability of what kind of things you can set.
In the VoiceOver utility, you've now got pitch, volume was there before, intonation, and I actually haven't changed that because I like the way it pauses between sentences. You've also got verbosity settings now. You can change them from high, medium, and low. Or you've now also got custom, so you can choose the different settings. I haven't played with it very much.
you now have Bluetooth Braille display support, so you can use Bluetooth Braille displays if you have one. You have something now, QuickNav, which basically allows you to use VoiceOver with only two fingers.
You'd mainly use that in a web page.
We just discovered today that, you know how on the iPhone you can use the dial when you're on a web page to turn the dial and then you switch from headers, links, flicking yes. up and down
yes.
to go through the different elements? You turn on that quick nav, and if you hit up and right and up and left at the same time, you can go through your rotor. And when you hit the up and down arrow keys without VoiceOver, it will mimic the same function almost. So you can go up and down by links, by form elements, tables. You can do down right, I believe, is to interact. Down left is to stop interacting.
And up and down together to select an item.
We're way past the point. I could actually turn VoiceOver back on again with the command F5, and we know it'll take a while.
Yeah, that's one thing you're going to notice is that during the install, the DVD has to spin up less.
VoiceOver on. Mac OS X installer. Window. Install Mac OS X.
They actually fixed a issue that Leopard had in the past with the installer. Apparently the volume's not low anymore.
It appears not. So you should now have a new...
Installing
you should
Mac have OS new, X on the yep. disk. Macintosh HD. 52.9% progress indicator.
There you go, folks. Hear the clicks. If you like to have some kind of audible confirmation...
progress indicator.
And the next line then will tell you the
time
approximate time.
About 9 minutes.
Did you notice the new sounds?
Yes, there's some new sounds in here, and they're not quite as abrupt as some of the sounds that I ended up turning off in Leopard.
And one of them is when you hit the edge of a window, it doesn't sound really harsh in your ears anymore. It's really nice now.
If you listen closely, Mike,
yes.
it's mimicking the sounds that we have on the iPhone.
That is correct. And they are positional, am I correct? If you're near the left edge of the screen, the sounds will come out of your left speaker?
Yes. If you have that feature enabled, yes.
It is by default enabled.
There's so much new
there is.
Stuff here. It is just... It boggles the mind. You can tell what we'll be doing this weekend.
If you're using the InfoVox voices, the Heather voice, the a cappella voices, you need to install the 2.0 beta before you upgrade. Otherwise, you may have trouble.
So you already have the voices. They came out within 24 hours, didn't they?
That's right. And the same with the Super Duper backup software. They brought out an upgrade this morning. That wasn't available yesterday when I did my install. But yeah, as you can hear, you get little progress clicks every so often, so you know something's still going on, which is very, very cool.
And if you ever want to check on your progress, you just hit VO-A.
VO-A. I put that red from the cursor to the end of the screen.
Well, in this case, it'll read what you're focused on.
So let's talk about the VO-A. It seems to have different functions based on where you are, but a very important command to memorize and use.
From what I could tell, when you're on a progress bar on a line of ever-changing text, it'll read you what's on that line. If you're on a website or in a document, it'll start reading you the whole entire document. They've implemented where you can do now from where you're at to the end as well. I think there's a separate command for that linked with VO-A.
One thing that we have found with mail, Leopard, you used to be able to just press enter on a message and it used to read from the top of the message down. You've got to do VO-A to read from the message down the screen. So that's something that people should be aware of when they use mail in Snow Leopard.
But you said there was some improved support for just using the arrow keys to navigate.
Now, I think it must be automatic because when you press the down arrow, it moves you between each line of mail.
Yeah, it's doing it now automatically. When you open up a message, I believe it even does it if you have the preview pane on.
Yeah, it does.
Another way of getting around that glitch is that you can leave the preview pane on, you just tab into your message, and it'll actually read the whole entire thing. So there's two ways of getting around that.
I think that Alex actually speaks more smoother than he did in Leopard. When he reads things, it just flows easier. You'll know what we mean when you hear it. The other thing that I have noticed with iTunes is when you're in a song table, from what I've been able to understand from the brief play that I've had, you don't have to interact with the songs table anymore with VO shift down arrow. It seems to automatically interact with it.
it does interact with it, and if it forgets to interact with it, you can just do it the old way and just interact, and it'll remember it. Most of the time, it'll do it.
When you're looking at a table on a web page, which I have briefly played with, it seems to work very similar to the tables in iTunes when you're looking for a song list, where you can go vo left and right to hear the name of the song, the artist, the album it's on, etc. The other command I have noticed, it's, I don't know if it was there before, vo R to read the current row and vo C for the current title. For some unknown reason, you're now seeing two tables when you go to the main screen of Skype. So the first table appears completely empty, just doesn't have anything in there. And the second table, if you vo right, are where your contacts are.
It actually threw me there for a while.
And me as well. I thought, hey, what's happening? Mm-hmm. Is my internet connection broken, or didn't Skype mm-hmm. load its contacts? And then I thought, I'll just vo right a couple of times. Sure enough, I found all my contacts.
And we found a few small little issues, I guess, with Adium, which, for those who don't know, is your ultimate messaging tool that lets you use Microsoft, the MSN, whatever they call it these days, Windows Messenger, AIM, Facebook. I'm trying to think of all the
Twitter.
Different apps. Adium does Twitter now?
It does in the beta, yeah.
Everything you need is in Adium.
And when we say Facebook, we're referring to chatting with your Facebook contacts. We're not referring to browsing people's pages and walls.
Interface with Skype. So pretty much all of your communication needs for social networking and messaging you can do through Adium. And there is a little issue, I think, where it says the word empty before a lot of...
Yeah, there is.
Okay.
Yeah, it does.
And with Syrinx, Twitter client for the Mac, it reads your tweets twice when you're arrowing up and down the tweet list.
I understand there's a way to rotor now through different voices.
When you hit now your vo command left and right arrow to go through your, you know, your speed, your intonation, different settings, there's now a setting that wasn't there before called voice. And you can simply up and down arrow and switch to whatever voice you want. The cool thing is that as you're switching these voices, once you let go of it, that voice gets saved, so now every time that you start up VoiceOver, when you turn on your computer or whatever, it'll use that default voice.
When you do Vo M twice to get to the status menu, or you can also do Control F8, you can actually go over to where it has the time, and if you let it finish speaking, if you arrow down once, it'll also now tell you the date.
And what I've always liked is it tells you the seconds. Now, some people may not care, but I liked it. It'll say 12:53:29. I think that is just cool. I've always loved this feature is you can have it tell you the time on the hour, on the half hour, and even the quarter hour. Myself working at home, I kind of like that. Every 15 minutes, it just lets me know what time it is, and it helps me kind of keep track of how much time I'm spending on projects.
Something else for MacBook users that they should be aware of, in Leopard, under the battery menu, you had adjust for best performance, normal, or better battery life. Apparently, those options are redundant in Snow Leopard. It must handle them automatically, and you no longer have those choices. It must work out what it needs to do without any intervention from you, which is a very cool thing, because honestly, I don't think those settings did much anyway.
Time remaining, about 3 minutes.
Wow, it's cruising right along.
93.0% progress indicated.
You can do gestures in that on the multi-track pad if you've got that.
Wow, like so you have the capability of the iPhone on your Mac, but you're now on a computer screen. Imagine the possibility when you learn where things are on the screen. Send it to resources@serotalk.com. If you have one of the new MacBooks with the trackpad capable there and you can actually do the gestures now, let us know how it works. Maybe make an audio recording if you like, or just tell us kind of what you found. And if it speeds up your computing session, or you really like just kind of knowing where things actually are on the screen. Have any of you played with the new QuickTime? I was kind of intrigued. I understand you can record with it, maybe even bring in a video file and mark the beginning and end and delete. You want to remove parts of it.
I have played MIDI files through it. They sound okay. I mean, I would like the synthesizer to be better.
I would suggest to people that when they've restarted for the second time and they hear all the cool music, which is in really nice stereo, after you've done the V to not go through the tutorial, I would suggest at that point you go and turn on that use hardware function keys F1 to F12 checkbox and reboot your Mac, and you should be cool. And eject the DVD as well.
Command E to eject that DVD so you have it out of the way.
Yeah. When you're sitting on the DVD itself, yeah.
Yes.
Either that or you can just hit the eject key. Just hold it down for a couple seconds.
What is the command for that if a new user wants to automatically bring up that voiceover tutorial?
It's actually Command F8.
If it's the new multi-track touchpad, you'll get to try the gestures out. It's going to restart. You might want to go to the top of the window and read what it says.
To click this button, press Control, Option, Space.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. You just heard
there you go. The install's complete. It's got to restart, and then we can get the party started.
Press Restart button.
Now, it's going to boot off the DVD a bit as well as the hard disk.
There we go. We have the music on the built-in speaker on the Mac, and shortly we will hear it in glorious stereo as we have it patched into the mixer. Yeah, I kind of like the music. It was funky. I want to go get that track off of there. I
believe there is a way of doing it, just a video performance, and I think they did it in GarageBand or something.
Apparently, from what I was told, when that's on the screen, it's actually saying welcome and hello in different languages on the screen colorful pictures, man.
The packaging comes with a picture of Snow Leopard, so people actually know what Snow Leopard is.
You'd pull out the cardboard sleeve, DVD in like a little plastic
Welcome to
pouch.
VoiceOver. VoiceOver speaks descriptions of items on the screen and can be used to control the computer using only your keyboard. If you already know how to use VoiceOver, press the V key now. If you want to learn how to use VoiceOver, press the space bar now.
There you go. I don't know. I'm tempted to go through this tutorial, but we know how to use it, and we've already gone on quite a bit. But funky music. I like that part. I don't know why it's kind of cool.
Well, it's 8:15.
And it even told me the time. This is to show that it remembers the settings that I had before. I don't know, guys.
And now you should press V for Victor.
That's right. Let's press V and move on.
VoiceOver on. Setup Assistant. Window. Mac OS X Setup Assistant. Thank you.
Interesting. Now, speaking faster, I was told that those who like to read fast are going to enjoy because the new VoiceOver can be sped up to read even faster than before.
There's a continue button here for you.
Time Machine. Image. Backup your computer. Finder. Image. Browser files with cover flow. Mail. Image. Email with style. iChat. Image. Chat using effects and backdrops. Spaces. Image. Organize your work. Continue button. Press. Finder. Desktop. Macintosh HD. Volume.
There you go.
And you're done.
Desktop.
You are currently on a volume inside of a group.
And there's what Jesse said. So it tells you after a few seconds, Apple really took seriously the suggestions on improving the training procedure. And you're seeing that in so many ways.
At this point, I'd suggest ejecting your DVD.
Yes. So let's tab to the
Mac OS X install DVD. Selected volume.
And I will press Command E. And the disk will pop.
Was removed from selection. Zero item selected.
Right on out. VoiceOver is not just a narrator for the Mac. It's a full-fledged, highly functional, configurable, powerful, and I'll put it in the class with any screen reading technology out there.
I'd agree.
I agree as well.
At no extra charge, folks. Nope. That's what Access technology should be. Just like the release of the iPhone, I think this is another day in history for Access technology. And if anyone's handing out awards, I hope they have Apple at the top of the list for 2009.
You've been listening to Serotalk. Visit us at www.serotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@serotalk.com or leave us a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB 2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us in 2 weeks as we explore all the internet and life has to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.